I'd like to welcome you all to the Writing Colloquia. This is actually the third Writing Colloquia series that we've had at the University of Dallas. The first one, though, that will be focusing just primarily on Litrad 2 and on writing the annotated essay. So I'm very excited about our lineup of speakers for this semester. I think we have some really, really fine talks about the art of research, what you do when you actually find the research, how you incorporate it into your own paper, what to do when you get into the library, all kinds of very, I think, both very practical advice and very theoretical advice. And though primarily targeted at Litrad 2, I think that the talks will help really you with any kind of research writing that you're going to be doing during your time here at the University of Dallas. So I'm very excited about them. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome our first speaker, Dr. Cowan. Now, Dr. Cowan is a professor in the English department here at the university, and he will be talking to us about how to discover a topic for your research papers, sort of the first step in researching. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I want to thank all of you all for coming and braving the weather, and for my own students, not only that, but the late notice that I sent out. I'm glad you're here. And thanks especially to Ms. Tiffany Niebuhr for organizing these colloquia. I think it's a valuable advantage that you and the audience are going to be able to reap the benefits of, I hope. All right, I'm supposed to talk about discovering a research topic. And I want to put the accent on discover. And what writing is a process of discovering meaning. Rather than being the development of some preconceived and well-formed idea, writing is the record of an idea developing. So I'd like you to think of it that way. It's a process whereby an initial idea gets extended and refined. We shape the utterances as we write. But careless of whether they're correctly formed, our only care is that they record our thought at that moment. Seeing our ideas on paper enables us to reflect upon them and develop them further, propelling our thoughts dynamically in a direction we did not know often that they wanted to go. Writers at this stage are miners excavating a seam of precious metal. And when the seam is played out, or we're interrupted, we get started again by reading what we've written and responding to it again, afresh. If we give ourselves honestly to this process, then eventually we end up with a product that teaches us something, that clarifies what we know, or what we have known only implicitly, and that lifts out our experience, enlarging it and explicating it. With any luck and with repeated application, you'll come to feel joy in the act of writing. Yes, I know it sounds crazy, but you can. Writing becomes a dynamical process when your mind is reacting to what you have just written and produces a response. We are dialogical beings. We seem to naturally produce dialogue even when there's no one there to dialogue with. Maybe perhaps especially then, we dialogue with ourselves. One comment naturally leads to another. By asking yourself, after you write down an assertion, how is this so? Or why is this so? You lead yourself up the path of developing it. Now, I don't want to give the impression that we're chained to what we've written on the page, that we're iron-bound to respond to everything we've said. Dead ends are frequent experiences for draft writers and are no-fault occurrences. Writing as discovery is a repeated process of beginning over again, starting out new. We have to be rash enough to leave a chunk of writing alone while we move on to writing about something else that stimulates us. Who knows, maybe when we come back to it later, it will sound better than when we left it. We'll worry about tying it together later. So, the process I'm recommending to you involves a letting go in the act of writing. Setting all your bullet points aside, just writing. Now, not about whatever comes into your head, quite. So not exactly what other schools' composition courses call free writing, but it's free enough, provided that you nail your shoes to the topic that you must write about, and then just let yourself go in a free direction to respond in every other way. I'm talking about the process of making something to write. Right? UD students should especially warm up to this notion of writing as discovery, since our university is committed to being a center of learning in which new thought springs from the soil of the great tradition, with students themselves taking part in that vital process of discovery that renews it from age to age. The UD curriculum stresses that there is something real to be discovered, that there is such a thing as truth, even though it is off there, gleaming in the distance. How precious that very simple recognition is. I'm here to tell you, after teaching for years at a public university, where any reference to truth grew increasingly scarce over the years, truth is hard to know and articulate and will almost always elude final and complete expression. It is not a given, but it must be discovered time and time again, each time in a new way. You bring life to it in having an insight. Writing is your means of discovering your own unique path to truth, a journey that creates meaning all along the way. For make no mistake, writing is the making of meaning. It is not the recording of a pre-existing meaning, but rather its creation. The act of setting down one's thoughts on paper to give them their full scope is in itself an act of learning. In developing an idea, discovering its origins and consequences, the writer finds that she has encountered an entire fabric of significance, which is not simply her own invention. It is in this discovery that she realizes the full extent of learning and becomes aware of the power of thought to alter lives and circumstances. Now, Herman Melville, while in the process of composing Moby Dick, wrote in a letter to a friend, "It will be a strange sort of book, I fear. Blubber is blubber, you know." Speaking about whales, "though you may get oil out of it, the poetry runs as hard as sap from a frozen maple tree. Yet I mean to give the truth of the thing, spite of this." The truth of the thing is all one need aim at. And it is enough. Without this commitment to truth, the UD seal has the word veritatem on it. There it is. Composition would become simply a way of manipulating tired material into something conventional, or alternatively into something temporarily new and perhaps entertaining. With truth as a goal, however much blubber it requires you to boil, good writing comes first of all out of a commitment to use composition as a means to better understanding. The billions of different perspectives that people bring to the reality that they perceive in the world tell of the need to know things from many perspectives other than one's own. This simple fact is not relativism. There is no one encoded truth, and for that reason, truth is not static. The admission of many perspectives, including your own, is an act of species-wide intellectual humility. No man is God. Right? No human being can know the thing as God knows it. Marvelously, this does not mean that we should give up trying. The vital need of the world for your perspective on reality is a wonderfully empowering thought. Although it can never be the final word, if you're lucky, you may achieve insight. And insight has that power to spring from mind to mind. That means it is more than just yours. Melville called this a shock of recognition that people could share. And Dante's Virgil explained that there are goods in this world that grow when we share them, defeating the economics of scarcity. Knowledge, insight, those are the kinds of goods. Those in love are the great ones. So get your pens and pencils going. The quest is for insight, not for self-expression. Now, ordinarily, the writer must conceive of the whole operation as consisting of two separate parts. First, using writing as a means of discovery, which implies writing without editing as one goes. And then the second movement, in which one applies all the effective principles of composition and rhetoric to the thought one has discovered. So effective communication is certainly one of the goals of writing. And teachers will famously hammer you for being unclear or sloppy. But effective communication is not the chief thing that college writing or writing in general should be about. Having to come to terms with writing an essay on a work of art provides a discipline to your thought that stems not from external paraphernalia, which are good enough in themselves, such as outlining, adhering to an assigned length, having a certain number of paragraphs, citing a prescribed number of examples, and all the structural devices that you will work on in order to complete your assignment, but from following the inner logic of your thought as you discover it and as you go and as it impels you. Premature and rigid attempts to correct and edit your work will truncate the flow of composing. When attention to form becomes the dominant and absorbing activity, the act of writing as discovery cannot be explored. So I hope I've emphasized that. Reluctantly giving up, then, any ideas of thinking out your papers entirely before beginning, you learn to fill your imagination with the work at hand and so discover the necessary freedom for original thought. Along with this discovery will come the realization of the importance of things like bold declaration of major premises, of seeing the inherent paradoxes in your assumptions, and of developing and extending your insights. And in longer papers, the process of revision, too, becomes an act of creation once writers have understood the main thrust of their thought and its necessary relationships. So it should be clear that when I say discovery, I do not mean only what is often meant by that word in rhetoric studies, the discovery of a topic that's a well-known topic that you can shape your own material according to. That means nothing more than being resourceful. By discovery, however, what I mean is discovery of what you really think, but didn't know you thought. Too many students approach writing with the attitude that they're supposed to already know all they need to know, and they just need to write it down. They need to prove their brilliance to an audience. In reality, you are still students, and writing is that process of continuing to learn, of really coming to know what you're learning. We're impatient with process, but process is what learning is, to be in that slow moment in which you ask yourself, what do I mean? And ask it again. The other questions you can ask yourself, what do I really think? What does this mean? What difference does this make? What concepts can illuminate this action? What ideas does this idea relate to? As you seek to integrate your learning at UD, some schemas that may prove useful when writing about literature include things that you learn, like the three parts of the soul in the ancient Greek tradition, right? Reason, spiritedness, the passions, and the appetites. The concentric spheres of order in which we participate, right? The family, the polis, the city, right? Past and present of the whole human race. The life world, nature, the cosmos in general, and the divine human relationship. All of those, we exist like nested circles within that. And they all cast different perspectives on a single fact that we might scrutinize. The virtues and the virtuous life. What is it? How is it realized? Always a perspective that I think I have found tends to be appreciated here by readers at the University of Dallas. But consult your own experience and your sense of what is right and wrong. After you know what your insight is, you start to apply the principles of rhetoric. Okay? So I hope that part, I've been emphatic, and I am very serious about that. In none of this have I yet said anything about specifically a research paper rather than just writing. So now we want to think about that additional burden of writing a longer paper, writing that annotated essay that freshmen have as their particular ordeal this semester. In longer papers, research papers or annotated essays, an additional step comes in and intermixes in the process of discovery. Research can help us discover what we want to write about. You begin with some general idea in mind, and as you research and write about what others are saying, you begin to discover what you want to say. The process of researching should be a process of discovery for you as well, not simply a fact-finding mission through the library. To be able to use the secondary sources you consult, you must read aggressively. Ask yourself, what is this critic's main contention? What is this writer arguing? Are there any ideas in this article that particularly stand out? Although, in that way, anything you read can be of help to you, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. Now, you may enter this process at any point, and in fact, reading and writing, right, are take their own interrelation as you enter into a project. You may have begun writing a few thoughts about an idea you have, and then turn to reading the secondary literature, speeding up the process when you take a book in hand by turning to parts of the book that are close to your subject. Or you may just begin reading without a clear idea, but with the hope of stimulating your mind, you know, waking up your mind to think more about your subject. As you see others do it, you start to do it in your own way. This may seem like a desperation strategy, but it's a pretty good one. If you don't have an idea in the world, park yourself in front of a book in the library and get to reading and then thinking. Critical books and articles are like a bazaar of ideas and arguments. You come to see what is out there. Reading these contributions encourages your mind to think more in terms of arguments and concepts about the world, about the work that you're researching. But the best approach is to already have a germ of an idea that you developed a little by sitting down and making yourself write in order to discover what you think about an aspect of the great work that you're researching. With that germ, your interest is narrowed and focused somewhat. You will encounter critics that enlarge and develop and add precision to lots of arguments similar to your idea. You'll also meet critical arguments with which you disagree. Both are grist for your mill. If you cite an opinion that runs counter to your contention, it shows your readers that you've been paying attention to the climate of ideas. That's a big impression, and honestly, I'm not kidding you, it gives that impression, even if you don't even have a notion what a climate of ideas is. So it's a helpful thing. If you can make a remark that indicates why you disagree with that critic, that's even better. Against the opinions of critics who contend that X, I maintain that Y. But, you see, that's a wonderful pose. But it's not always easy to do, and it's not really necessary. It's helpful, if you can do it. All right, what does literature itself show us about this mysterious process of research? Interestingly, it just so happens that the two authors whose work concern you this semester, Dante and Milton, were both real grinds. Amazing encyclopedic minds who had studied everything. They knew everything there was to know in the learning of their times, which included ancient philosophy as well. So they're eminently worth your study. There are many paths of inquiry into these great epic works. But those authors, that medieval and early modern as they were interested in the results of their studies, not in that process of finding. The greatest research report ever written is a classic that you'll read next year in our literary tradition sequence. And some of you may think, of course he's going to say this. Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Melville drew on an actual whaling voyage he had taken when he was a young man, trying to earn money for his family. It was, by all worldly reckoning, a tremendous mistake and a failure. Conditions on board were unendurable, and after a while on ship, he jumped ship on a tropical island, was stranded for a while, managed to survive, and made his way back to New York. He wrote about the experience in fictional form and made a great success with his first book. So it was only after he had published 5 novels that he turned back to that experience of whaling, determined to make something of it, determined to transmute all that terrible experience on the whaling ship into novelistic gold. And he succeeded beyond his wildest dreams, not for the popular market, not for the critics of his day, but for all time. Melville has a genius in meditating on, in writing, on his experience. It was then not only the experience of whaling, but also his actual working it up as a subject of study that he reworks into his immortal novel, arguably America's greatest classic. And University of Dallas is arguing the great continuer of the epic tradition in the modern world. Uniquely, Melville gives us a novelistic record of his research. This we find at the very beginning of the book. Now, I suppose somebody can tell me the first sentence of Moby Dick. Anybody? Call me. Well, sorry, this is a trick question. Because it's really not Call Me Ishmael, although that is certainly a very famous sentence. The first words of Moby Dick read as follows. Etymology, supplied by a late consumptive usher to a grammar school. The pale usher, threadbare in coat, heart, body, and brain. I see him now. He was ever dusting his old lexicons and grammars with a queer handkerchief, mockingly embellished with all the gay flags of all the known nations of the world. He loved to dust his old grammars. It somehow mildly reminded him of his mortality. Now, if this unpromising figure and another rather like him, the sub-sub-librarian, Melville leads us into his whaling epic, it is these librarians that are the guides to his library study that helped him to work up this experience of whaling. He is, of course, not giving us a factual record of his readings or his research. He's giving us a fiction that shows that this event happened, that this process took place, and that what is happening in this epic is great because of what is going on in the mind of its composer, who is also a fictional character named, you got it, Ishmael. So he gives us a fictional record of his readings in the section titled Extracts, which he places just before chapter 1. And yes, that famous Call Me Ishmael. This prefatory section is a poetic representation of how research can shine a light on elements in your own mind. He does not trace how passages from his readings get worked into the book. Indeed, that transformation remains mysterious, as it should. But the extracts are crucial in awakening us readers to the process of writing a work based on knowledge, as to an extent all epic poems are. Now, there are over 100 extracts, very short selections from various kinds of reading. And they all supposedly were found by this fictional character, the sub-sub-librarian, whom he says is the humblest person in the entire library and would never speak out anything for himself at all. And he imagines that after the end of his life, the sub-sub-librarian will come in and they will clear out the seven-storied heavens of long-pampered Gabriel and Michael and place the sub-sub-librarian there as the humblest of the humble. Well, it's an exaggerated, you know, jeu d'esprit that he gives, but it's still a sense that the humblest in pursuit of knowledge is indeed doing the greatest thing. He spent long years, says Melville, picking up whatever random allusions to whales he could anyways find in any book whatsoever, sacred or profane. In any case, Melville cautions us, you should not think the higgledy-piggledy whale statements, however authentic, in these extracts for veritable gospel cetology. They merely do part of the work of turning that whale's flesh and blubber into writing and print and knowledge. They afford a glancing bird's eye view, writes Melville, of what has been promiscuously said, thought, fancied, and sung of Leviathan. So through this we get the notion that the reading can be quite broad indeed, if your topic is a great one, and there can be things far from seemingly your own central topic of study that will nonetheless be worth bringing in. It will enrich it. So for instance, Melville dutifully quotes from Plutarch, "And what thing soever besides cometh within the chaos of this monster's mouth, be it beast, boat, or stone, down it goes, all incontinently, that foul great swallow of his, and perisheth in the bottomless gulf of his paunch." That, I think, perhaps 17th, 18th century English translation of Plutarch. There's Hobbes, right? Thomas Hobbes, the first sentence of his Leviathan. "By art is created that great Leviathan, called a commonwealth or state in Latin civitas, which is but an artificial man." That passage seems to be in there just as a general nod to learning. He's mentioned, Hobbes is, and then just left alone. But he's enlarged the topic of the whale just by his presence. And there's the testimony of Melville's own times. 19th century, first-hand accounts of great whaling voyages, among which I particularly like Miriam Coffin's for its brevity and power. "Suddenly a mighty mass emerged from the water and shot up perpendicularly into the air. It was the whale." Sounds briefly terrifying, and indeed that's a foreshadowing of things to come. But there are entries of greater substance and meaning, references to the book of Jonah and the book of Job, especially, which many commentators take to encompass Melville's greatest themes. Just so, your readings may turn out to be only samplings of the critical climate, or they may stimulate you to a height of thinking you could not have scaled on your own. Either way, you're in charge. And the process of researching your topic is not simply to gather information. It should interact dynamically with your thought, changing, redefining, and specifying your topic and your argument as you reflect on it. Research, like writing, is a process of discovery. That's it. Thank you. I will take questions. Yes, uh-huh.
Change a lot. Recently, we had a wonderful conference here at the university that was on King Lear, and I'd struggled, and I don't know why, very hard to write. wrote a paper on Peter, and then went to the plenary address that the invited speaker gave, and it was on the same topic. And I realized earlier that evening, I've got to write a whole new paper tonight. So yeah, I do rewrite. And of course, you know, it's a terrible habit. It can be a vice, but that kind of pressure can sometimes make you, you know, write with more directness and even with more insight. Can't promise it. Yeah, you have to revise. But like I say, it's no fault. No one's keeping score. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, thoughts? Have you started thinking about this annotated essay yet? Mm-hmm. You will have to soon. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I just had a question. You mentioned earlier that sometimes it's better to, once you have a topic, just to write without editing and mm-hmm. stopping to see.
Oh, right.
I find that like impossible for me to do personally. Uh-huh. Yeah, each time I have a paragraph or a thought, I'm always checking to see it's okay, because I don't know, I fear if I go too far and realize everything's wrong. So I was just wondering mm-hmm. how far should we not, I mean, how much should we not really worry and just write, try to get a whole draft?
Well, the two processes are not connected, really, to each other that much. If you're writing, you know, if you misspell as you go, if you miss your punctuation, if you repeat words, if you don't write in balanced paragraphs, all that can be done as repair work. You know, it's not anything that you feel like if I go too far, I'll go off the edge of it, yeah. of my argument. So I think you can go ahead and do it without fear, and come in and edit later. Editing, of course, is torture. You know, having to read your own writing, nothing can be more painful. But that's a thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, I have a suggestion. I wonder sometimes when we're typing, if we feel like it needs to look perfect because we think that it's in a perfect form. So when I'm feeling like I'm stressing too much about the way a paragraph looks, sometimes I'll write by hand. And then I don't know if I misspell it, if the spell check doesn't tell me, and I don't really care about punctuation.
Good. All very good comments. Yeah. These are, you know, tales from the kid of writing.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think you don't necessarily have to write it down the first draft. A lot of the times, if you just sort of write it in your head, or write it in conversation, actually, that's where I find that process of discovery works really, really well. We find, you know, a really good friend. The main thing I give these guys about you really want to hear what they have to say, and they'll push back, and you will refine it in that process.
Well, we often find that when we get down to writing, then it's all slipped away because the verbal,
yes.
The oral medium is so fluid. So it's good to put something engraved on a piece of stone or something. If you don't have your paper or your computer. I don't know. I mean, it's quite personal how you find is the best way to get started writing. I used to feel I had to carry around a yellow pad because there's nothing else that really worked for starting. Lately, I've gotten to where I almost live on the computer, and so it's just easier to just start, you know, dancing over the keyboard. But there comes a point, even when you're writing something from the beginning, and it's spell checking and doing all of that, I'm kind of wary of that automatic spell checking, where you say, well, I've written all this, I don't know where to go from here. Of course, take a break, but also print it out, put it on the table, take out your pencil, read it, and say, let's see what I think about all this. And feel free not just to correct yourself, But to say, that makes me think of an additional point, and then write that down as much as you can. That's a valuable part. Seeing it in a different medium has a certain magic to it that you can exploit and keep going. But there's nothing like a deadline to focus. Still true at my age. Have you done critical papers before, looked at literary criticism? I'm interested to know because I'm about to ask my own students to do something like this. So, let's see. Yeah. Did you have a question back here? Yes. Given.
I did. I was just wondering how you sort of judge between which critics you allow to and
really
change your...
How to judge between which critics?
Which critics that you really allow to change your argument and
mm-hmm. which ones you like them or not. No, I don't know, but that's really kind of how I would say, because sometimes an author can be quite wrong-headed, but be drawing on some important sources of thought and can point you toward some important arguments that person uses, whether you like the general argument or not. So lots of times you're reading just to see what you can stir up, and make that connection yourself. We look for that, and we look for an active mind. It's so important to see that. I would say almost as much as being right about everything. the act of actively thinking and engaging these works is so important. But that's really, I think, why we want you to do this kind of critical paper. It's not like a library paper in which you go there to get information. It's not really a research project of the kind you do in science. No, it's a critical paper where you expose yourself to the mature thought of other thinkers about these works and tell what you think. So it's all meant to increase your autonomy. Independent thinkers, right? University of Dallas, the School for Independent Thinkers. All right. Other comments, questions? And thanks for coming once again. I'll see you in, 2 weeks?
Oh, and do we have to, do you want us to write a staff paragraph?
classes are like that.
No, no, no. Yeah.
Just like those.
Yeah.